you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM. Holy cow, that was awesome. That totally reminded me of Cowboy Bebop. But that was J.G. Thinwell doing the Venture Brothers opening theme. And that is to bring us to our guest, which is Pat McEwen, who is currently doing the storyboards on the Venture Brothers. So nice segue. You like that? Yeah. Anyways, I don't want to talk too much just because the interview is great and I want to play it for you guys. So I'm just going to talk a little tiny bit about Mr. McEwen and all the great things that he's done, because it kind of seems like he doesn't really do a lot. Like, he like showed up in the 80s and early 90s as fully formed awesome wicked artist, and then sort of shows up every so often, little dribs and drabs here and there. But he has been currently working on an amazing graphic novel for Johann Safar's publishing company, and it should be out soon enough, sooner than hopefully later. But anyways, he got his start with Aircel. It was a Canadian comic book company in the late 80s. They were doing a lot of stuff with Barry Blair and his elf stuff and ninja stuff, and that's where he hooked up with Dave Cooper, and they worked together a few times, you know, leaving Aircel and coming back. But in his private career, because even though he has done like a lot of sort of mainstream stuff, like, he also has done some underground alternative stuff as well. So it's, you know, we'll be talking about all of it. It's a mishmash. But one of the earliest things I found by him was an issue of Pervert, which was put together by Gavin McInnes. And it showcased Gavin McInnes's artwork as well as Dave Cooper's and Pat McEwen's. And he, I swear, you know, the Pervert came out in like the early 90s, and his artwork was so fully formed, so graceful, and so tight, like insanely tight, using brush, using pen. It just, it looked really good. And I guess, you know, the time on Aircel really made a difference. He also did an underground comic called Underground, and it was sort of a mystery with squatters and punk kids. And his style at that point was really angular and sort of not fully formed. It wasn't as tight as the work in Pervert. He went on to get noticed in Grendel War Child, that came out in 1992 with Matt Wagner writing and Pat McEwen doing the art. The art is wonderful. Like, it, I quite like it. It's very action-packed and it's all over the place. It's very it's really professional looking. It's not something you'd expect to find in your typical alternative comic. It's, you know, Pat could easily go on to do superhero comics, and that was in 92. He went on to do Grendel Homecoming in 1994, which was illustrated by, or not illustrated, sorry, Pat McEwen illustrated it, which was inked and colored by Dave Cooper, which, and he added a real sort of textural content to Pat McEwen's art. So he's done other stuff since then, but I kind of want to get to the interview. We'll talk about the other stuff in between the interview bits. Pat McEwen is talking about the beginning of his career, and then we also continue. To hear the whole entire interview, eventually it will be posted on the website. I think the interview was like maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours. No, that's exaggeration. I think it's about an hour and a half. And you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM. This is the Onomatopoeia Show, where we talk about all graphic arts all the time, and I'm just going to get right into it. This is the Pat McEwen interview. Check him out online if you want to know what he looks like. His art is really, 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 really good. So here you go.
We're talking to Pat McEwen. He is a comic artiste who's been toiling away on a graphic novel for years. But we're going to talk about your early work and go right on through to the end.
Okay.
When did you start drawing?
Drawing, or drawing professionally?
Just drawing.
In earnest, probably when I was about 12, like comics specifically 12, but I mean, I've been drawing since I was like 7, 6, something like that. My older brother drew a lot and read a lot of comic books, so I think at first I was just emulating him, and you know, gradually he stopped and I just kept going. So
as a child, did you think you would have a comic book career?
I don't think I ever thought about it in terms of career. It just sort of materialized. It was just something I did all the time. So when opportunities arose, I just sort of jumped at them. And it, yeah. But no, it wasn't like I didn't have a burning ambition to be a cartoonist. It was just something that I did a lot. And I worked in a comic book store, so it was just really present in my life. Mm-hmm. So
what store was that?
It was a place called Arthur's in Ottawa, which was a pretty seedy secondhand book and record store, and okay, they also sold men's magazines, and it was, yeah, it was...
Sounds perfect.
Yeah, it was pretty, yeah, it was quite a place.
So you got involved with Aircel at a pretty young age, like, was yeah. that 16? I'm not sure.
It was 1985. I mean, Barry Blair was doing stuff prior to that, like, okay. I would have been about 12 when I met him through Dave Cooper. And he was producing a bunch of zine things, you know, pretty slickly published things.
Was he doing the Elf stuff then?
Yeah, it was Elf Lord. Elf Lord. Yeah, just... when they say it out loud,
yeah,
it's pretty funny.
As someone who works in comic book stores, yeah. I see that stuff all the time.
Yeah, well, that's too bad. but it was one of those things. There was nothing else going on at the time, and it, when you're 12 or 13, it seems like, wow, you know, this guy's making it happen. And I guess, yeah, like around 1985, he was working in insulation, and the grant that the company had was running out, and the guy who ran the company was looking for a new business venture, and Barry convinced him that comic books would be a good way to go.
And was it? Well, you guys were pretty prolific.
Yeah, well, there wasn't a lot of quality control, unfortunately. It was taking advantage of the glut in the black and white market and the explosion of independent comic books. So it was kind of a strange time. It was really a speculative economy. And, I mean, it happened again in the 90s with all the Todd McFarlane crap. But that initial boom, yeah, it lasted for about 3 years. And we were publishing a retarded amount of material. And
what did you start doing? Were you just inking, or did you go straight to drawing? Or?
God, it was never really clearly defined. It was we were kind of doing a little bit of everything, depending on what needed to be done.
And that was at the age of 13?
A little bit at that point, but it wasn't, the professional thing didn't happen until I was 17, so, but it was sort of always going in some respect, like Barry was always producing something, and I think Dave and I drifted away when we were about 13 or 14, but then we came back when money became an issue. And neither of us were particularly, I guess, committed to school or anything like that. And so the first opportunity we had to work full-time in what we thought was a great field, you know, kind of jumped at it. So it seemed pretty exciting at the time. But again, there was a lot of momentum and not a lot of looking at what we were doing. But things were emerging around us, things like Yummy Fur and... trying to think of what else was kind of good at the time. Raw was happening.
There was also like the ElfQuest stuff and the Kamiko and the Eclipse. And
yeah, Eclipse had some good stuff. I remember Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers, and there were a few other things, but none of it really lasted. Like none, you know, most of that stuff is kind of a footnote today. Mm-hmm. I guess a few things might have. Yeah, there's nothing from that initial black and white glut that I can really recall, and it's probably just as well. I think a lot of
Cerebus, come on.
Well, yeah, I'm not gonna go there with you, but I would say most of that stuff just ended up being like farm team stuff for the majors. Not too many people had a real committed vision of something exceptionally different from what was going on in the mainstream. It did sort of open it up to be the kind of more cinema-friendly thing that it is today, I think, and it definitely changed things for creators and gave creators a lot more leverage, because it did prove to be competition for the big companies. Mm-hmm. But they did get around that by just sort of hiring those people. So,
smart way.
You know, they kind of co-opted into it. So, yeah, whatever spirit of independence was going on, I don't know, it seems to be, I've been just kind of absorbed.
When did you do Underground?
That was mid-period Aircel, and I think we were doing well enough for them to entertain the idea of something that was a little less genre-oriented, although the book's still pretty tied up in genre conventions, and it's pretty melodramatic, but it was an attempt on my part to integrate something that was close to my day-to-day reality, something, you know, verging on autobiography, but mm-hmm. it's still pretty heavily fictionalized. I'd spent a little bit of time in London at that point, but I think so, or maybe that was just before. So it's kind of, you know, it's a little less genre-oriented than something like Baker Street, but it's still pretty inchoate. I don't know. It's
well, it was the time period that you were growing up in. Yeah. It's not like it was just totally off the top of your head.
No, I mean.
And I'd imagine after doing all those elves, you wanted something you could relate to.
Yeah, well, there was always an impulse to do that, and it had sort of infiltrated some of the other stuff, like the action titles like Samurai, and I tried to take that in a more, I don't know, artsy direction. It was kind of misguided and pretty pretentious in a lot of ways, but there were some things brewing that have definitely come to play in more recent work in a much more kind of mature way. I'd say the graphic novel that I'm working on now has
I thought you saw that.
Striking resemblances to earlier work, which I was surprised to see. I'm like, wow, I'm still working with a lot of the same themes. But
you try to exonerate them, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a catharsis.
Totally. I mean, just not having the vocabulary at the time to really, or the perspective on the experience to really frame it in a way that seems believable or
well, to me,
mature.
It's kind of special. I mean, it's the snapshot of Canadiana that there's not really anything like it at the time. Like, seriously.
No, it's true.
Dave wasn't doing anything like that.
No.
Yummy Fur isn't close to that at all.
No.
I mean, like, what other Canadian alternative independent comic was coming out at the time that encompassed that sort of scene?
No, it's true. And, you know, I've had kind of, I don't know how you'd describe it, but I have peers in the industry who are fond of it. They kind of tease me about it, but it was something
that's so heartfelt. Like, yeah, even the inside front cover is like all cut and paste your name.
Yeah. It was pretty, yeah, never mind the bollocks. I didn't do that part. I think that was Mike Charbonneau. I think I art directed some of that stuff, and they pulled my back cover. They put that stupid photo on the back, unbeknownst to me, because the back
cover... Are you guys in the French Metro, or where is it?
No,
the London
that's New York.
Okay.
Yeah. But, yeah, that really pissed me off, because the back cover I had was the guy getting punched through the back of the head, and they pulled it at the last minute, I think. They justified it as, I can't remember, responding to a concern of the printers or something like that. But they were pretty underhanded that way. They'd sort of say, oh yeah, everything's fine to your face, and then...
I get the impression that a lot of these early independent Canadian publishers were really fly-by-night. I've heard the same kind of stories from Bernie and Moreau.
Totally, and a lot of the American guys, Bernie and I both got caught up in the Cameco thing. And when they got bought up by, I think it was Andrew Rev, there were all kinds of just parasites. You know, people who didn't really know much about business, and they were eager to take advantage of a property and try and exploit it to, you know, to the extent that they could. And so there were all kinds of shady business practices. I won't go into it, but it was, you know, none of these guys are around today, but I think a lot of naive young guys like me and Bernie were really willing, wanted to believe that these guys had our best interests at heart, or the medium for that matter, much less the business. You know, we were inclined to sort of buy the line up to a point, but when it got to people like Andrew Rev, it just became the predatory nature of it. And this notion of these this legion of publishers who were just, they had no place in the business or the medium at all, and they were just looking to find a way to make money.
Quick buck, yeah.
So it was pretty gross.
When did you and Aircel part ways?
It happened.
You're listening to CGLO 1690 AM. This is the Onomatopoeia Show, the show where we talk about all graphic arts all the time. That was Pat McEwen. He is the creator, well, the illustrator behind Grendel Warchild. That's what most people know him for. But he's done so many other things that are so much better, like Zombie World and some Hellboy Jr. and lots of fun, cool stuff. We're going to continue with the interview with him a little bit more, but I want to play some music for you. All the music was chosen by Pat. The first track we're going to play is Howlin' Wolf. The song is called I Asked for Water, She Gave Me Gasoline. I really enjoyed the fact that Pat picked some of this music, in fact, all of the music, really, and because I got into some stuff that I wasn't into, so that's always really good. Anyway, so here is Howlin' Wolf, I Asked for Water, She Gave Me Gasoline, CGLO 1690 AM.
Rodney Gasoline.
Hey, this is the K-Man. Tune into CJLO.com on Friday nights from 9 p.m. to 12 a.m. for Beyond That Graveyard 3 and start your weekend the right way, always. You love it, you need it. Beyond That Graveyard Part 3 on CJLO.com.
Bellevue, that's it. I mean, sometimes you just ain't all there.
Thank you.
And you're listening to CGLO 1690 AM. This is the Onomatopoeia Show, where we talk about all graphic arts all the time. And that was Per Ubu from his album, The Shape of Things. And it was actually a live recording from 1976, which I thought was really cool. The track was Final Solution, chosen by Pat McEwen. And before that, we had Helen Wolf, I Asked for Water, She Gave Me Gasoline, from the album Moaning in the Moonlight from 1956. That was a fantastic choice, which it made me feel pretty good, only because I've been really into this, like, ska revival thing. I've just been, you know, springtime's coming, I want some peppy music to go with my summery sort of walks before it gets really cold again. And ska really does it for me, and so I've been listening to a lot of these Trojan box sets, and I really want to play some of it, but I can't because of the constraints of my show. So I'm glad that Pat picked Helen Wolf, because while it's not ska, it still has that really, you know, sort of bluesy feel to it that I quite like. And of course it sounds like it was taken from a record, and I love the sound of records anyways. those ancient discs that people used to listen to before CDs and MP3s. Just in case you don't remember. We're going to have some news, and then we're going to go to some more Pat McEwen. I've got an interview that I'm playing, and we're going to talk about more about his art. But let's do some news, because there's some really interesting stuff out there today happening in the world. Okay. Not only am I really into ska this past couple weeks, but I've also really been into the Muppets, mostly because I've just finished the Street Gang book, which is the complete history of Sesame Street, and it was fantastic. It was really well written and very interesting and totally in depth, and I wanted him to write another book about the Muppets, like, right now, so I can read that right now. But of course, you know, you can't always get what you want. Anyways, the weirdest thing is that this company, Boom Studios, is releasing a Muppet comic book this week. Say that 10 times fast. Muppet comic book this week. And it was written and drawn by Roger Landridge, which is totally fantastic. It's in full color and it looks fabulous. Landridge is totally the perfect choice. I got to stop saying totally, but I should just tell you right there the emphasis of how excellent Landridge is for the Muppet Show comic. It looks great, and I can't wait to get it. They also published this company a series about The Incredibles with a cover by Mike Mignola, and the writing duties are helmed by Mark Waid. So that looks pretty sharp too. I don't know who the artist is, but it's not bad. It doesn't look bad, which is great. I mean, these are the kind of things you need to do to ensure that children start reading comics and continue to read good comics, is make comics that's appealing to them and their age level. And admittedly, I'm an adult, but that Muppet comic looks awesome! Let's see, also Jay Stevens, an alternative creator who did King Tutenstein and lots of really great comics that I love, like Land of Nod and stuff like that. He did designs for a cartoon called The Secret Saturdays, just like a family, I guess, of superhero crime solvers. Anyways, they're so popular, they've made them into toys. And I think that's really cool, because Jay Stevens' art really lends itself towards action figures and the kids' toy milieu. So I kind of love the fact that a lot of the comic book people that I enjoy or have enjoyed in the past are now, like, in this position where they're making cartoons and their characters are being turned into action figures. That's so cool. Anyways, let's see. I just got this from the Sequential website. This is kind of bizarre. Some people from the Degrassi TV show are involved in a stage production about the adult lives of the characters from the U.S. comic strip Peanuts. A Dog Sees God explores what might have happened had the Peanuts kids grown up and entered high school. Isn't that bizarre? That's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. And last but not least in the news, I just found out that Don McKellar is supposed to host the Doug Wright Awards, which I find very interesting, and it makes me actually want to go now. I mean, initially I was going to go to the Toronto Comic Art Festival anyways, and still am, which is on May 9th and 10th. And the Doug Wright Awards are held there because they are the literary awards handed out to Canadian cartoonists. You know, usually when I attend these kind of things, I have a tendency to hang out with other people and drink and have a party and have a good time and not really sit around at an awards banquet while other people win awards, and I just sit there and stare at the four walls. But with Don McKellar hosting the festivities, it makes that a little more intriguing. Anyways, you're listening to CGLO 1690 AM. So endeth the onomatopoeia news. And now we shall go on to the wonderful and great Pat McEwan. Now, Pat McEwan got sort of quote-unquote famous by doing work on Grendel, War Child, and then subsequently Homecoming. But the things that I like by Pat McEwan, the things that really got me into him, is he did this wonderful one-shot in little short story in Minimum Wage Number 9 back in 1998. And it was interesting because the thing is with Pat McEwan, it's almost like he has three different art styles. Like he's got his, you know, really basic superhero-y sort of the stuff he was doing in the beginning, Aerosol style. Then he's got his like really tight Grendel style where it looks super professional and really, you know, well laid out, looks really excellent. But he's also got this goofy sort of, I don't know if it's what he does his autobio styling, but it's sort of wavy, Gary Panter-ish style that's got a lot of stuff happening within the panels. And then he's also got a super highly stylized animation cute style. So he's got a wide variety of styles, and you know, it's one of the reasons why I quite like him, but I especially like the cute stuff. And you know, he makes hot women look really good, and he does, yeah, it makes the what you're reading a little more interesting when you've got like these beautiful gorgeous women and they're like decapitating men. Yes, that was one of the stories. But in Minimum Wage, it was an autobiographical comic, and that was the first time I got turned on to Pat McEwan, and I was like, wow, this is really neat. And then, you know, I saw his stuff in Hellboy the Junior, which is really cute and adorable. And then he did some stuff with Dark Horse Presents with Ed Brubaker. But the most genius thing I think he's ever done, like the most awesomest thing, was this little snippet comic. I think it was about 5 pages in Weasel Number 1, which came out in 1999. If you are a fan of comics at all, you should own the Weasels because they're written and illustrated by Dave Cooper. They're so lush and beautiful. The story is really fascinating and in-depth. And within issue 1 is this awesome story by Pat McEwan, which should be, you know, used in schools for educational purposes. You can read it any single way and something is happening and it's sequential. You can read it up and down. You can read it back to forth. You can read it left and right. You can read it right to left. Like it's just, and it's interesting and fascinating, and it kind of reminds me a lot of the sort of silly symphony Looney Tunes cartoons where people are running everywhere and they're showing up above your head and below your head and around your head. And I think Weasel 1, that little bit that Pat McEwan did, is probably one of the best things he's ever done, and it's fantastic. And it also, if you get the Dark Horse Book of the Dead, which came out in 2005, you can see the style which he's working on now, which is a sort of Johann Safar style amalgamated with his own style, which is really sketchy and full of depth and percept. Like there's like, you know, black holes you can fall into behind the characters, and they have these big cutesy eyes and really clean lines too. And so that was the Dark Horse Book of the Dead by Pat. There's a story in there by Pat McEwan if you want to see what other stuff he works on. He also has a real goofy sense of style too. Like he does a lot of kids anthologies, you know, did things with Disney Adventure Magazine. He did a series called Luna Park in 99. And then he did some stuff for kids in the Scatterbrain anthology put out by Dark Horse Presents. And even his Bizarro stuff it's a little on the risque side, but at the same time it is, you know, it's for general audiences. So he has a style that is really accessible to a lot of different people. He also appeared in Flinch, the anthology, and Heartthrobs, the anthology, and Strange Adventures, the anthology that were all put out by Vertigo, which are great anthologies. Don't take my word for it. Just go look them up. Heartthrob, Strange Adventure, Flinch. If Pat McEwan's in them, there's bound to be other people in there that you totally like. So, you know, you can trust me. Anyways, the other things that he's been doing lately is storyboard. He's a storyboard artist. He's done work on Batman Beyond and X-Men Evolution, and currently he's doing the Venture Brothers. We'll get into more of his artwork, but I just want to get straight into the interview because we're running out of time, of course, like usual. You're listening to 1690 AM. This is CGLO, and I'm going to play for you some of the Pat McEwan interview I did with him a few months ago. So enjoy.
When did you and Aerosol part ways?
It happened a couple of times. There were several kind of restructurings of the company as the independent glut sort of waxed and waned. And there were a lot of internal struggles about the direction the company should be going, and also productivity. So I guess it was 87, yeah, it was when I left for good. But I'd been laid off and then called back once. It happened. There was like a brief coup in the company at one point that I wasn't really part of. It was a really kind of turbulent time. But, you know, in retrospect, a tempest in a teacup. So, yeah, it was kind of ridiculous. The people at the helm had no idea how to run a business, but...
How does it make you feel to realize that Barry Blair is still publishing his Elf stuff?
Is he?
He doesn't publish it himself, but okay. It is still coming out. It's okay. MBM has published the last couple books. Yeah, they're I don't know, you know, sometimes I look at those comics and I really wonder about Mr. Blair. I don't want to tell tales out of school, but there's a lot of prepubescent Elf children running around. I find it mildly disturbing, actually.
Well, yeah, it's a controversial topic and not one that I feel like I can expand on because it doesn't just involve me and there are other people's privacy to take into account, but, you know, nothing illegal went on.
Oh, no, I'm not suggesting that in the least.
No, but, you know, I'll just, you know, let the material speak for itself.
It's very interesting.
But he's not quite the bad guy that everybody makes him out to be.
Oh, I'm not making him out to be. I don't even know anything about him.
I just mean he's been much maligned in the press, and some of it is well-deserved, but he has redeeming qualities. And actually, Dave Cooper and I sort of touched on it in, Dave's interview in the Comics Journal.
Yep, so, I was reading that,
okay, so if anybody's kind of
interested. That's online. That's a great interview because it's not so much an interview as it is a conversation between you guys. It's like, because usually interview is a give and a take, right? But you give a lot as well as the interviewer, not just Dave.
I think that's what Dave wanted because he was a little apprehensive about doing the interview and he didn't really want it to be... a typical interview. He wanted it to be a little bit more organic, and I don't think he wanted all the attention to be on him. It sort of comes out. It's a very long, drawn-out interview, and a couple of people have sort of given me backhanded compliments about it, or, you know, about maybe...
Well, maybe because I'm just a big nerd, but I loved it. I was like, this is great. This is like, I'm there. You're describing it completely. Yeah. Like, it's not... And it's two different perspectives, right? It's not just, you know, one-sided. So.
Yeah, well, and I think Dave wanted to avoid just the typical fan questions. So we tried to address things that lay people would want to know or fans, but it was kind of more... Yeah, setting up a conversation where the stuff would just sort of come out if you're inclined to look for it.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of Dave Cooper, when did you get involved with Gavin McInnes and Pervert? Because it's kind of incestuous. Like, I was actually going to include Bob Fingerman in that triptych as well.
Well, yeah, Bob doesn't have any dealings with Gavin at all, but I knew Gavin and Bob.
And was Ron Turner involved in this as well?
Ron Turner, yeah, not really.
Okay, Ron, clarifying.
Yeah, Ron was specifically a BC chapter of the whole affair, but Gavin I knew vaguely from the Ottawa scene. He was a friend of friends, and he didn't really get in touch with me until after I'd moved to BC, and he had been in a couple of bands in Ottawa, Leather Ass Butt Fuck and Anal Chinook, which I'd never seen. But I knew him as a person and sort of a fixture on the scene. He seemed to me at the time to be a bit of a tourist, and he kind of came in at the late part of it for me, but because he had never lived in one of the communal houses or, you know, any of the he hadn't really been involved in any of the early phases of it, but he came on strong and he had a big influence on the later phases of the scene, clearly in the zine community. But once I'd moved to BC in the early 90s, he, I guess, became aware of my career as a cartoonist, and he didn't pursue me or anything like that, but he initiated, you know, some communication, and through a mutual friend, we got to know each other a bit better. Dave didn't come into the picture until later, and I think Gavin might have met him through me or independently of me in Ottawa, but it was after I was gone. Gavin used to travel a fair bit. I remember he came out to Vancouver at one point when Pervert was still going. We jammed on a thing there, and I can't remember if I did the stuff for him before or after that, or, you know, coincided with that. And somewhere in between that and the beginning of Vice, I made a couple of trips to Montreal, and he had, you know, tried to convince Dave and I separately and together to kind of get on board with an early publishing venture. And I think Dave and I were both hustling in the freelance thing and trying to make names for ourselves in the independent scene and in the mainstream, and Gavin's thing did seem a little bit fly-by-night, and I think we were wary because of people like Andrew Rev and Barry Blair, that we wanted to see something...
Before you committed.
Yeah, just to see if he was going to be sticking around and if he was committed to what he was doing. And I can't speak for Dave, but my own commitments kind of took me in a different direction. I still did stuff with Gavin, but I wasn't able to really jump on board with it. And he'd initially proposed the record label, and that was his... Or no, I can't remember. He had an idea about the record label around the same time he had the idea for the tabloid, which they were working for The Voice, which was a welfare project, an employment project for people on welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when it got into trouble financially, they just did a hostile takeover. And again, I think Dave and I were sort of invited in, but failed to take him up on it. I guess it just didn't seem
Dave
like...
Well, Dave did contribute a bunch of Pip and Norton comics.
Yeah, that was later, after it had sort of established itself. He and Gavin had a much more in-depth relationship in terms of collaboration, but that was after the... It had gone from a tabloid to a magazine in New York, but we both contributed strips to it when it was a tabloid, and they switched from The Voice to Vice, and then they went to New York. But really, my only presence in that magazine for the longest time was the horoscope icons.
Okay.
And I did some stuff more recently. I designed some toys and did some illustration, but Dave was pretty consistent in his contributions, as far as I know.
Pervert would be the beginning of that
relationship. Pervert was, and it was fun. I look back on my contributions, and I feel like it sort of missed the mark. I was kind of in my own little world in Vancouver, and it didn't really have that much to do with a lot of the other stuff. Gavin was really involved in the zine scene, and especially the bande dessinée thing here in Montreal. And so there were a lot of comic jams with a lot of independent cartoonists, but he had his sights set on much bigger things. So it was just sort of a phase in his thing. But he always maintained a respect for it, and he helped a lot of his friends out later.
Oh, yeah, he's very supportive of the comic industry, which is great.
Yeah.
When did you get involved with Matt Wagner?
That was in Montreal in the late 80s. So after Aircell folded, I came to Montreal just to live with an old roommate, and I wasn't doing much. But I bumped into Bernie Moreau, and he mentioned that he just finished up a stint on Grendel, and that Matt was looking for an artist, and that Matt was actually here in Montreal. His wife, Barb, Barb Schutz is from Montreal, and Diana Schutz was I guess with Kimiko. Yeah, they were, sorry, I'm kind of losing track. It's 20 years ago.
It's okay.
So she was still married to Bob Schreck, and I remember having a meeting with Matt separately and then with all four of them, and and I got the job doing Grendel.
No, that was War Child?
Yeah. It hadn't been named yet. It was still just Grendel. It's the next chapter of Grendel. Tim Sale was still wrapping up his pages.
Was it scary going to something, like, way more slick?
No, because it really wasn't at the time.
Like, it's only now in retrospect it seems way more slick.
Yeah. Well, at Kimiko, it was still kind of, I guess Bill Willingham was their only other big guy, and, you know, Matt had made his name doing that, but... Bernie's was the only chapter that I'd really read.
I'm a big fan of the Panda Brothers stuff as well.
I'm kind of ambivalent about those guys. There are things about it that I like, but I never read them because there wasn't really any storytelling per se.
Were you reading comics back then, or were you still kind of like your too cool for punk kind of?
No, I mean, I've always read comics, but I've always been kind of... particular about it. I was never aligned with a particular series. I would get obsessed with particular artists or writers for a while, but
back then, who was influencing you?
It's hard for me to recall. There was a lot of stuff in the mainstream, obviously, but I think because I'd gotten into it so early, 12, 13, and my taste had been shaped by people a lot older than me. So I was still kind of reaching back, and there wasn't a lot of stuff. Like, people like John K. Snyder and the Panda Brothers just didn't do it for me at all, because I thought the storytelling was pretty awful.
Mm-hmm.
And that
Well, they're pretty bombastic and definitely, like, a what's the word? They're definitely iconically 80s. Like, and there's all both those guys, Snyder and the Pander Brothers.
Well, and I think it's like styles that really didn't transcend that. And
no, that's one of the reasons why I kind of like it. Yeah. Because it's like, I'm not, like, that wasn't my time period, but at the same time, like, it's really different when you compare it to the standard mainstream, you know, Marvel or DC that was coming out at the time.
Yeah, I guess.
It's really style-heavy, though. Yeah. You know, the shoulder pads are out to here, and the chins and eyes are really angular. And
yeah, well, and again, because I wasn't invested in that kind of stuff very much, I felt pressure to conform because people had expectations about the series, but it just wasn't. It was never going to be something I was going to attempt. So I was still... People like Mobius. In terms of genre stuff, I always look to like Corbin and Mobius, because I'd been seeing heavy metal since 1977.
Okay.
So I was about nine. Yeah, I was nine when my brother brought home the first issues. So a lot of the European guys had a really prominent influence on me from an early age. So.
CJLO. You're listening to CJLO.
Heavy-ass rock, badass metal, and kick-ass hardcore, every Wednesday night at 9 with Turn Down the Sun.
You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM. This is Black Mountain with their track No Hits from their self-titled album. This is the Onomatopoeia Show, where we talk about all graphic arts all the time. And that interview where you heard that guy talking, that strange man that you don't know who he is, that's Pat McEwen, the legendary Pat McEwen. And he was telling us all about his history within the comic book world in the late 80s, early 90s. Anyways, we're going to go to more of the interview. And I just wanted to say that there's a lot of great stuff that Pat's done. But the coolest thing that he's ever done that I've seen, besides that Weasel number one, which was fantastic, is I actually managed to get to see an exhibit that he did. It was his final graduation piece. I might be messing this up, but it was amazing. It was just amazing. He had gotten somebody else to knit this giant thing in the middle of the room. You could walk through it. It was all part and parcel of the mood he was trying to create with his ink drawings that were on the wall. And I just loved the spaces that he created with his art and his drawings. There were trees that bled into pipes, that bled into buildings in the middle of nowhere. It really reminded me a lot of growing up as a child in Ontario. In the middle of nowhere. I feel bad because I'm telling you all about it and you can't really go see it, but it was wonderful. And there, I'm pretty sure there's probably some images online somewhere, because it was a really long time it took him to do the work for this exhibit, but I felt very special to be able to see it. Anyways, Pat's doing a graphic novel right now for Johann Safar's company, and I haven't seen anything of it, but if it's anything like his Dark Horse Book of the Dead, it'll look good, I'm sure. And that's the thing about Pat. At this stage of the game, he could do anything and I'll probably buy it. So yeah, what better compliment can you pay than that? Anyways, we're going to go back to the interview. You're going to be listening to Pat McEwen. If you are curious at all about his work at all, you can just look him up online. He started with Grendel Warchild. He went on to Grendel Homecoming. He co-wrote Zombie World with Mike Mignola and did all the art for it. He gets around. He's there. You just got to dig a little. You got to find them. Anyways, you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM, and this is the rest of the interview with Mr. Pat McEwen.
Right. As a formative influence, because I encountered it when I was about 9.
That's heavy metal,
yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
It cut me off.
Sorry.
No. Oh. When I said the bit about heavy metal, it was like it hadn't started yet.
Oh, okay.
It was still... Okay, start again. Cut. Okay. Take two.
Okay.
You were just talking about how heavy metal influenced you.
Yeah, it was a formative thing, because it happened when I was about 9 and my brother brought them home around that time. So pretty, yeah, probably a little early to be exposed to that kind of material, but also National Lampoon part of that. And you were just mentioning Bill Ward in Crack magazine and how weird that was. Yeah. And
Lampoon was pretty, like, I've got a couple issues of the comic book specials.
It was pretty pornographic.
Well, yeah. There was like a lot of early Bon Baudet is in there. Mm-hmm. And like it's all over the map.
Yeah, I remember seeing some fairly confusing things. But having seen them in retrospect many years later, it's kind of...
Do you think that formed your art, not style, but just like your sensibilities, like what you want to write about, what you're passionate about? Because I have to say, a lot of what you illustrate has a really dark sort of tinge to it when you consider the thing that you did in Flinch. I mean, I know it was written by Bob Fingerman, but then also the zombie world that you co-wrote with Mike Mignola.
Oh, yeah, and when the graphic novel comes out for Gallimard, it's, you know, still, although it's geared for an adolescent readership, it was commissioned specifically for an adolescent readership, it still deals with some fairly dark and difficult subject matter, albeit through, the lens of melodrama, so it's still kind of beholden to the conventions of melodrama, but I think there's, it's getting in a pretty dark subtext, mm-hmm. So it's always there, and I don't think you could locate it in National Lampoon specifically. I think that's just symptomatic of other things.
The time.
Yeah, lots of circumstances, and nothing, no single thing specifically. So, and it's not that I had a very dark childhood or anything like that. But I've always been interested in the things that are unspoken and the things that are repressed. And there was a time in independent comics where that was seen as regressive, and it was like kind of ghettoized as immature and just shock material, but I think time has come where a more considered approach to it will be kind of accepted. But I remember guys like Joe Matt and Chester and Seth were, and the sort of the orthodoxy of independent cartoonists, mostly men, who were trying to distance themselves from genre stuff and wanting to appear more urbane, would kind of poo-poo stuff that dealt with, I guess, what they saw as more puerile material. And I think they were right up to a point, but I think the baby got thrown out with the bathwater there for a while, and it, as a result, independent comics became kind of detached from their subject, and you can see it.
Well, it was just like the black and white boom. You've got a sudden glut of everyone unloading their neuroses.
Yeah, well, and a lot of repressed and really immature stuff that wasn't, you know, well thought out or, you know, didn't have the time to gestate. And
is that why you refrained from doing a lot of autobio? Because most of what you've written hasn't been autobiographical at all.
It was tough, mostly because I felt people that I knew, like the guys I just mentioned, plus Chris Ware and Dan Close and Julie Doucet and a lot of the emerging women writers had just done a lot of the things that I wanted to do, and I didn't really see where I could contribute in an original way. It's just taken a while for me to kind of find my place. And around that time I was sort of frustrated with the orthodoxy that did arise for a while, and it was sort of like, this is good, this is not good, and people were sort of picking teams, and the fact that I worked in the mainstream made it difficult. It was also a question of finding the time to do it, because I couldn't make any money doing that, and that shouldn't be the deciding factor, but at the same time, I was really struggling to stay afloat financially, and I was spending a lot of time with guys in Seattle like Jason Lutz and Ed Brubaker and John Lewis and Tom Hart and Megan Kelso, and they were all doing, you know, pretty much autobiographical stuff. You know, I collaborated with Ed on the one short piece for DHP, which was really fun. I did some stuff for John Lewis. And all of this, I wanted to do more personal work all the time, but I was always really just struggling to get by and wasn't...
Well, the other thing, too, that I've noticed in your career is that you've been very focused on your education as well. Did you start that when you were doing Grendel, or did that come after?
Well, yeah, I started Grendel when I was in Montreal in the late 80s, and then I moved to BC to be with my girlfriend of the time, and as soon as I got out to BC, Cameco went under, and I was laid off for about a year and a half, and while Matt and Diana were shopping Grendel around to various publishers, Dark Horse eventually picked it up, but there was a legal wrangling with this guy Andrew Rev, who'd taken over Cameco, and he was asserting his right over the property.
I think we're just going to leave it there. You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM. This is the Onomatopoeia Show, where we talk about all graphic arts all the time. And that was my interview with Pat McEwen. There's lots more content, and give it a couple of weeks and it'll be up on the website, www.cartoongal.com. I played some Black Mountain for you earlier, and now I'm going to play some Deer Hoof for you. This is Holy Night Fever. And it was great having Pat do the interview with me. It was really interesting talking to him, and the music that he's chosen is just great. I love it so far. It's been awesome. You're listening to CJLO, and up next is Lonesome Stranger. Next week, I think it'll be the Bernie Moreau interview, finally, because I've got it. We can play it. We can do it, and we're gonna. Yeah. On that note, here's some Deer Hoof for you.